Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight. Christopher Pyne makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute, this time in his capacity as Shadow Minister for Education. I'll introduce him very briefly. Educated at Adelaide University, where he graduated with a law degree. He's been the MP for Sturt since 1993, when he was a very young man. He's still a young man. He was a minister in the Howard government. He held a number of important parliamentary positions over all that time, but currently Shadow Minister for Education, Apprenticeships and Training, and of course Manager of Opposition Business in the House. And tonight Mr. Pyne's going to talk to the Sydney Institute on the topic Achieving Teacher Quality, a Coalition Approach. Christopher Pyne, very welcome. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Jared, and it's a great pleasure to be back here at the Sydney Institute to continue to support what I think is an excellent institution in Australia in terms of public policy. And I've had the opportunity to be here on a number of occasions over the years, and I've always used it as an opportunity to talk about something of substance in my own portfolio, or that I think is an important public policy debating area. To Nicholas Johnson, your chairman, and to the most importantly, of course, to Hilary Visser, the mother of the op-ed editor for The Australian, which is the real reason I'm here, of course, is to lobby for more op-ed space. And, of course, most importantly, to Adrian Piccoli, who has graced us with his presence tonight, the State Minister for Education, who is fighting the good fight to change education in New South Wales, which is no mean feat. Ladies and gentlemen, school education policy and suggestions for its reform seem to be a topic on policymakers' lips. It's hard to open a newspaper or turn on the radio without coming across it. No one appears satisfied with the lot of school education right now. Part of this surge in interest has related to the Gonski Review and the federal government's school funding model. However, a broader policy debate has also emerged, focused on how best to improve the outcomes being achieved by Australian schools. In my speech tonight, I will speak about both the wider context of this debate as well as the potential for policies specifically focused on improving teacher effectiveness. Historically, Australia's education system has performed relatively well. According to the OECD's Programme for International Student Assessment, PISA, 2009 results, of the 65 assessed school systems, Australia was ranked 9th in reading, 10th in science and 15th in mathematics. These results were significantly above the OECD average on all three measures and ranked us clearly above nations like the United States, UK, Germany and France. However, between 2000 and 2009, Australia's performance had slipped, and a number of school systems, particularly in East Asia, have overtaken Australia. Between 2000 and 2009, Australia was one of only four countries to record a statistically significant decline in student reading performance. And this decline occurred despite education spending over the same period increasing in real terms by 44%. So we're paying more and achieving less. For the last 5 years, we've heard a constant stream of rhetoric from the current federal government about an education revolution. Instead of a revolution, what has been delivered is a masterclass in wasteful spending and appalling mismanagement, all without any tangible impact on what actually matters, improving how and what teachers are teaching so student outcomes are improved. But perhaps we shouldn't be surprised. After all, the fate of the education revolution was predicted over 90 years ago by Franz Kafka, who wrote, "Every revolution evaporates and leaves behind only the slime of a new bureaucracy." The truth is, the education revolution was never going to deliver on the promise of Labor's rhetoric, because Australian education did not need a revolution. What it needed and still needs are two things: practical policies that are focused on addressing the shortcomings in our current system and effective implementation of those policies. As I've highlighted, the major issue facing our current system is slipping student outcomes. There are three sets of policies needed to address this. These policies need to be designed to improve the quality of the curriculum, to improve the quality of teaching, and to improve the school environment. In other words, how schools, their facilities, and their staff are resourced and managed. Under our constitution, the state and territory governments have the responsibility for schools, a situation that limits the scope of policies that can be pursued at the federal level. That caveat notwithstanding, the federal government has a vitally important role to play, and if elected, a coalition federal government will act to address all three of these policy areas. Specifically, at the last election, we promised that a coalition government would firstly review the national curriculum, widen the consultative process, and invest to ensure that teachers are able to access the professional development support they need to effectively implement it. Secondly, act to give government schools autonomy. In our view, this is the single most important step we can take to enable schools to engage with their students and parents, as well as to effectively address the specific local issues faced by individual school communities. And thirdly, improve the teaching in our schools. And this is the issue that I propose to focus on tonight. The standard policy prescription to improve teaching in the past has been to hire more teachers. The argument goes like this: more teachers equals smaller class sizes. Smaller classes equates to more personalised instruction for children, which in turn leads to improved student outcomes. It's a simple argument, and one that has resulted in enormous amounts of wasted government spending for a long period of time. Conversely, a recent Grattan Institute paper on teacher effectiveness concluded, "The evidence overwhelmingly shows that investing in improved teacher effectiveness rather than the number of teachers is the most successful method of improving student learning and creating top-performing education systems." Extensive academic research into the effectiveness of the class size policy has produced two remarkably consistent findings in both Australian and international studies. One is that reducing class sizes is incredibly expensive, and secondly, reducing class sizes does not meaningfully improve student performance. Policies pursuing a further reduction in class sizes will not work. We need a new approach to improve the teaching in our schools. Most people have been exposed to great teaching and terrible teaching in the course of their or their children's time at school. They intuitively understand the importance of teacher quality. This intuitive sense is supported by extensive international and domestic research that has found the quality of teaching is the most significant predictor of student outcomes apart from family background, and increasing teacher effectiveness outweighs the impact of any other school education program or policy. If we want to address the ultimate issue, the slipping academic performance of Australian schools, then improving the effectiveness of our teachers is critical. So what actions can the Commonwealth take to improve teacher effectiveness? There are two different groups of teachers to address: prospective teachers who are still in training or contemplating a career in education, and current teachers who are already working in schools. There are two major measures that can improve the effectiveness of new teachers entering the profession. First, ensuring that those seeking to become teachers have a strong track record of academic attainment, and second, improving the quality of the pre-service education that new teachers receive. Over the last 10 years, the requirements to enter a teaching course at Australian universities have declined. For example, the average tertiary admission rank, ATAR, required for undergraduate teaching courses in Victoria declined from 75 in 2004 to 67.5 in 2011. In regional Victoria, the average is only 59. This story is true across the country, with minimum admission standards commonly in the mid-50s to low-60s. So what can we do about these declining standards? A number of commentators appear to advocate the wholesale adoption of the education policies of other nations as a panacea. Finland springs to mind. While these kinds of arguments are simplistic and unhelpful, I do think we can usefully look to international experiences to provide some insight into what might work to address the unique set of challenges facing Australian education. To this end, a common feature of the East Asian school systems that have performed so strongly over the last decade is the strong academic track record of the people who become teachers. For example, a 2007 McKinsey study detailed that Singapore draws their teachers only from the top third of the graduating secondary school class, and Dr. Jensen from the Grattan Institute has noted that the South Korean system is even more selective again. But by way of contrast, the Productivity Commission here in Australia recently estimated that approximately one-third of those enrolled in Australian pre-service education between 2005 and 2010 had Year 12 results that placed them outside the top 30% of their class. The Coalition recognises the need to ensure that the next generation of teachers are above average academically, and we support the recent moves to ensure that education courses generally only take candidates with literacy and numeracy skills in the top 30% of the population. However, putting a floor under the entry requirements really just addresses a symptom of the wider problem, which is that a career in teaching is not appealing enough to the highest calibre candidates. A 2009 survey of school leavers revealed that only 1% of high achievers, defined as a TER over 90, had teaching or education as their first preference for university. The report also revealed that those people who did want to study education were the most likely of all school leavers to rate the level of HECS and having confidence in meeting the demands of the course as being major influences on why they wanted to study education. Rated less important than other fields was the idea that teaching extended on subjects liked as part of Year 12. So this evidence suggests that increasing numbers of students are choosing to study education because they think it's cheap, easy, and it does not extend or deepen the knowledge they gained during Year 12. And when I think about the pipeline of new teachers that we need to address our slipping student outcomes, these are not the characteristics that I would like to distinguish it. To be clear, I'm not suggesting that all new teachers joining the profession fit this profile, and I've met many excellent young teachers who've chosen to pursue a career in education for all the right reasons. However, this study does highlight our core challenge to widen the pool from which we draw our new teachers and to make teaching an appealing career to high-calibre people who currently do not consider pursuing it. This is not an easy task, but an independent program like Teach for Australia has shown great promise. Teach for Australia, for those of you who are unfamiliar with the program, is the local manifestation of Teach for America, a program that has been successfully operating in the United States since the early 1990s and to date has been instituted in various guises in 24 countries. The program works by enlisting high-achieving recent university graduates and professionals to teach for at least 2 years in a disadvantaged secondary school. Teach for Australia associates are not graduates of traditional pre-service education courses. Instead, they undertake a 6-week intensive initial training course at the University of Melbourne before they begin teaching and then complete a postgraduate teaching qualification over the following 2 years. Programs like Teach for Australia can be justified on the basis that they are effective at providing high-quality teachers to disadvantaged schools. However, I believe they have additional unique value in their ability to make a career in teaching sufficiently prestigious and appealing to attract our top university graduates. Let's consider the results of the program internationally. In 2011, Teach for America received 48,000 applications for 5,200 places, an 11% acceptance rate. 18% of final year Harvard undergraduates applied to Teach for America in 2011, and 8% of final year Oxford students applied to Teach First, the equivalent UK program. one in five graduates from America's most prestigious university, itself with an acceptance rate of only 6%, now want to work as teachers in the poorest schools in the country. And one in 10 graduates from Britain's most prestigious university, apologies to any Cambridge graduates present, want to work as teachers. And keep in mind that the Teach Next program only began in 2002. Given this international track record, Teach for Australia and other similar programs show potential to fundamentally alter how people view a career in education. The second imperative to improve the quality of new teachers is to ensure that they have received high-quality teacher training or pre-service education. Currently, however, pre-service education is not preparing new teachers adequately for life in the classroom. For example, in one survey, only 41% of teachers agreed that their training had left them well prepared for the reality of teaching. Another study suggested that a majority of teachers felt that their training was helpful in preparing them in relation to only 8 out of 15 key teaching skills. Similarly, principals felt that new teachers were well prepared in only 4 out of 10 key areas. A central criticism by both teachers and principals is that pre-service education is not well targeted on those practical skills that teachers actually need to be effective in the classroom, in areas like managing a classroom, conducting assessments, and reporting and communicating with parents. Singapore has an excellent system of pre-service education. One of the key strengths of their system is the close link between the National Institute of Education, the sole provider of teacher training, and schools. These close links have enabled schools to provide direct feedback to the NIE that has led to the replacement of subjects like the history and philosophy of education in favour of courses focused on practical teaching skills. There are obviously many differences between Singapore and Australia, not the least of which is our federation, with its separate state and territory systems. But I do believe there is scope to profitably create closer ties between providers of pre-service education, their graduates, and the schools in which the graduates begin their teaching careers. Those closer ties could have benefits ranging from improving the focus of pre-service education courses to improving access to practicum placements or ensuring that new graduates have ongoing support and mentoring in their early years in the workforce. Importantly, the federal government has the power to directly influence the creation of those ties through the university compacts that it has with Australia's universities who provide pre-service education. If a coalition government is elected, I will investigate the most effective way to ensure that the requirements of pre-service education are appropriately focused on the practical skills that new teachers need to succeed in the classroom, initially through the creation of a ministerial advisory board. We will also adapt the current university compacts to increase the level of ongoing mentoring and professional development provided to their recent graduates in training. In addition to improving the effectiveness of new teachers, closer links would provide much-needed feedback to providers of pre-service education, allowing them to continually ensure that their training reflects the needs of new teachers and schools. Effective professional development is a feature of most highly successful private sector organisations. Likewise, the top-performing international school systems have a focus on the performance of their current staff, not just new recruits. While mentoring and professional development systems do formally exist in Australian schools, they are deeply ineffective. The 2009 Teaching and Learning International Survey, run by the OECD, revealed that over 60% of Australian teachers feel that appraisals of their work are conducted solely to meet administrative requirements and have minimal impact on the way they actually teach in the classroom. Instead of a useful tool to improve teacher performance, what has been implemented is just a check-the-box administrative burden required to satisfy central office. Unsurprisingly, these systems fail to recognise and encourage high-quality teaching. 9 out of 10 teachers say they would not receive any recognition in their school if they improved the quality of their teaching. The systems also fail to manage poor performance, with 71% of teachers reporting that in their schools, teachers who display sustained poor performance will not be dismissed. We can and must do better than that. The Productivity Commission has recently made a number of recommendations about the implementation of effective teacher professional development systems. The central element of these recommendations is that these systems must be school-based. Principals must take the lead role in determining how their school should monitor and improve performance. Central agencies must be limited to supporting and enabling these efforts, not directing them. While the federal government cannot introduce these types of measures directly, we think they are vitally important. Accordingly, if elected, we will make the discretionary federal funding that is currently paid to the states, for example through the national partnerships, contingent on the introduction of genuine school and principal autonomy. State governments are currently responsible for allocating some federal discretionary funding to non-government schools. While we are committed to ensuring that this funding does not flow to states who do not act to give schools genuine autonomy, non-government schools should not suffer for the recalcitrance of their state government. Accordingly, the Coalition is committed to providing discretionary federal funding directly to non-government schools and school systems. That'll please you, Bill. Ultimately, our efforts in conjunction with state governments to introduce genuine principal and school autonomy into the government school system will create the foundation necessary for principals to develop their staff appropriately, hire the right staff for the right positions, and manage underperforming teachers effectively. Many of you will be astonished to hear the experiences related to me by school principals on their current inability to be able to appoint, manage, and develop staff that so many of their non-government school principals take for granted. Just last year when I was in Brisbane, a government school principal told me that his number one priority was to recruit an excellent English teacher for his school. In response to the new teacher request, the Education Department in Queensland sent him a teacher with specialist skills in fine arts. At a gathering in Victoria with several non-government school principals and one government school principal, the government school principal shared with the group how she was envious of the neighbouring non-government school principal's ability to be able to appoint staff and manage pay incentives to reward the best teachers in their schools. She explained to me at length her frustration over the years at her inability to retain some of her best and brightest teachers or seriously manage underperforming teachers at the school. I asked her if she was so fed up with the government school system, why had she stayed and not left to join a non-government school? And she replied that she had a deep commitment to public education and had learnt over time to simply manage underperforming teachers. She also stated her hope was that one day the system might improve and that someone with the political will would come to implement the changes that are so sorely needed. Well, a coalition government will not let principals down, will not let parents down, but most importantly, we will not let the students down. We will give principals and parents a real say in the running of their school. The future of our government school system depends on it. Thank you very much.
Many thanks to Christopher Pine. Just stay there. We'll go to questions and discussion. Before we do, I should say thanks to King and Wood Mellisons for their use of this fine facility this evening. So we'll take questions and discussion from on broadly on the topic. So you've covered a lot of important points tonight. Can I just broaden out beyond? We'll come back to your topic, but just broaden out a bit to the issue of the Gonski review. Julie Gillard, about one of her last major speeches as Education Minister here in this room a few years ago, announced the formation of the Gonski report. It didn't have the names then, but the idea of this kind of report. Peter Garrett spoke for us recently and said that that government funding would be assured for non-government schools pretty well said in an indexed manner. Not quite, but pretty well. So how are you looking at this from opposition at Gonski?
Well, thank you, Jared. But firstly, Peter Garrett has never committed to funding of non-government schools in real terms in the next funding quadrennium. He has very much said that no school will lose $1. And when constantly pressed by the non-government school system, by the media, He has steadfastly refused, as has Julia Gillard, as has any member of the government, from committing to funding in real terms. Now, if it's not in real terms, it represents anything from no cut, if it's almost in real terms, to $4.2 billion cut to non-government schools over the next 4 years. The coalition is committed to funding in real terms for the non-government school sector over the next quadrennium. We've made that commitment, Tony Abbott's made that commitment, and that will be delivered. On the Gonski Review, it's very important in understanding the Gonski Review to note that for it to be implemented, the Gonski Review requires $113 billion of new funding over the next 12 years, starting in 2014. Now, planning the education funding debate around $113 billion would be like my wife and I planning a household budget around winning Powerball on Thursday. It is quite irresponsible. Now, Mr. Gonski has done a very good job at bringing together some very interesting information, and he has a very highly regarded panel. But it's not really good enough, in my view, to drop a report on the government and say, well, if you deliver $113 billion in real spending increases over 12 years, this is going to be a pearl of a policy. But if you don't, well, it simply won't work, and then ride off into the sunset. The government doesn't have $113 billion. The states don't have it. Adrian doesn't have it, I don't think, unless he's got a hidden log somewhere. The federal government doesn't have it. Most of the states have already ruled it out that they will have any of that money to provide for the Gonski Review. So therefore, without that money, the Gonski Review is unimplementable. As Bill Daniels is fond of saying, if there's no money, there's no model. Even with $5 billion a year in 2009 terms over the next 12 years, starting in 2014, that represents a cut to many non-government schools. Now, the Latham private school hit list in 2004, which is unfair on him, it was really the Jenny Macklin private school hit list, but became known as the Latham school hit list, had 60 schools on it, 60. There are 1,170 schools that are funding maintained in the non-government school sector that would lose money under the Gonski Review, certainly if no money was put up, and even if there was money put up, hundreds of schools would lose money under the Gonski Review. And I see representatives of the Catholic Church here, and I'm sure that they would have something to say if they had the opportunity about funding maintained and about the support for non-government schools. Your question was, what's the coalition's position? We don't believe that the SES funding model is broken. I could spend half an hour explaining all the aspects to our response to the Gonski Review, but fundamentally, the SES funding model is based on objective data, on the data collected by the Australian Bureau of Statistics. It doesn't penalise private investment, but actually rewards private investment. So it doesn't penalise schools that collect fees or make wise investments in previous generations or do fundraising drives that mean that they can have particular kinds of facilities. And until there is evidence presented to us that there is a better model, the coalition is committed to the SES funding model. The Gonski Review is not a better model because the money to implement it simply isn't there.
Right, so, and you might help me with the microphone.
Especially for calling him grumpy, Andy.
You're okay, but other people don't stand up to discuss the camera, so just sit down when you like.
Chris, I feel bit bad after hearing your talk because I brought with me a copy of the Grattan Institute's report,
yeah,
and it hasn't been reported very much in the press for some whatever the reasons are.
There's a lot on.
Yeah.
That's the problem.
Oh, sorry. Did you hear the first bit?
Yeah.
What I'm concerned about is politically, it's one of the, what you need to do is not politically palatable, I don't think. And I'm reminded of the industrial relations problem that we had in the previous elections, the coalition had the previous election. And I'm wondering if your colleagues appreciate your view, and do you think it's achievable to implement it?
Well, I very much do think it's achievable. I think parents of school children across Australia, there are 3.6 million thereabouts children in schools, both government and non-government across Australia. That's a lot of parents. and also grandparents who take a keen interest in their grandchildren's education, I think they are very much ripe for someone talking about the elephant in the room in education, which is teacher quality. It's not enough to simply keep saying, well, if we put extra money in here or extra money in there, or do this program or that program, maybe we'll be able to patch it up. The evidence in the PISA report was really startling. A 44% increase in spending and a reduction in outcomes. No one can argue with that. For years, the Australian Education Union has used the PISA results to demand less or more money, smaller class sizes, more teachers. Well, they've essentially had their wish over 10 years. State Liberal and Labor governments gave in to the mythology of smaller class sizes for 10 years. And it's been manifestly unsuccessful. The evidence is there, and parents, I think, are aghast. Everyone wants the best education possible for their children, and the one thing that that needs to be done in education is teacher quality. A great teacher in not very good facilities can still produce tremendous outcomes for their students. People have been doing it for hundreds of years. Good facilities are great, they make a better school even better, but a good teacher is the most important ingredient in a school. So I think there is definitely an appetite in both the public and in the political class to implement real reform surrounding teachers. And I really take my hat off to the work that Adrian Piccoli is doing here in New South Wales. It's not easy to say to the education unions, we are going to reform the school systems in this state. And they love a strike. But I think people are really sick of it. They're sick of strikes, they're sick of industrial action, they're sick of protests, they're sick of orange and red in Macquarie Street. They basically want governments to get on with governing, so I think there is a lot of political will for real reform that addresses the key issue of teacher quality.
I just want to ask, that was my question, even Labor governments in the state have tried to overcome the teacher union monopoly on public education. And I've had one Labor minister sit at dinner and explain to me how impossible it all became. If you're really going to do this, and I think there's a hunger in the ordinary average family community for this and has been there for a long time, you really have to break the back of the stranglehold of the teacher unions on the bureaucracy of the public education system. And that's really a state government matter, and it has to be bigger than just putting out something that people will vote for. So how's that going to happen?
Well, happily, Anne, we now have Liberal governments in a number of very important states, including this one. And if we have a federal Liberal government or coalition government, then there'll be a meeting of minds on one of the most important issues, which is principal autonomy and local governing control. I think that's probably the first time that will have happened. I think the public and parents are thoroughly sick of the old debates about teacher unions and industrial action and strife in schools. They can see that their children or their educational outcomes are not as good as they should be. They read it all the time. As I said at the beginning of my speech, it's hard to turn on the radio or open a newspaper without there being a story about quality in our schools. I think there's a strong political will for real reform. I even think there is, in the Labor Party, an understanding that things have to be done differently in the future. But the Labor Party can't take on the teacher unions because they are so enmeshed in the Labor movement. And even if there is a reforming Labor minister somewhere in the country who wants to reform education, it's almost impossible for them to do so. It's a bit similar to Nixon recognising China. The Labor movement will never be able to take on the Teachers Federation. Only Liberal governments will be able to do that. But I think the enthusiasm by which teacher federations and unions are supported in their old-fashioned views about education is very much on the wane. And even the industrial action that's been taken in recent weeks in New South Wales hasn't been met with anything like the marching in the streets that Terry Metherill was met with in the Griner government.
Thank goodness.
Thank goodness, otherwise Adrian wouldn't be here.
Now, we've got plenty of time, so if everyone behaves like a good schoolroom, Lindsay,
I'll be the teacher. Yeah.
I want to ask more of the same about efficiency and delivery. Under the current Labor government, it hasn't been a good advertisement for demonstrating that Canberra can deliver programs, especially in education and the environment. When Tony Abbott wrote in battle lines about his time as a health minister, albeit in the context of state Labor governments, he said he was more and more of a centralist because it was the only way to get things done. Are state Liberal governments, assuming the Liberal Party, the Liberal National Party is in government next year, whenever in Canberra, is the presence of state Liberal governments going to stop you being a centralist? And when you were a minister under Howard, did you feel the advantages of centralism and decision-making in Canberra over states' rights?
I don't believe that bureaucrats in Canberra are somehow magically better than bureaucrats in the states. I think that the states have very important responsibilities in transport, health and education, and I don't think the federal government should try and cover the field in the areas that have been left to the states. Obviously, over the last 112 years, more and more power has devolved to Canberra, but local decision-making should mean local decision-making. Local decision-making at the school level, at the state level, local council level, and so on. So I'm not a centralist when it comes to education. I don't plan on taking over schools across Australia. I don't think the federal government would be any better at running 9,500 schools than the state governments have proven to be. But I think the federal government has a role to play in encouraging the states in a particular direction. And we've made it absolutely clear since before the 2010 election that a central tenet of the Coalition's education policy in schools is principal autonomy and local governing control. Nobody in the education space could think that would be a surprise if we are elected and want to move in that direction. The one thing we can influence the states over, of course, is spending and money. So where I don't run any schools, we have a lot of discretionary programs. They call them the national partnerships at the moment, but they've been around for a long time, whether it's literacy or numeracy or other programs. And I'm going to make the payment of those funds to the states contingent upon the states accepting that principal autonomy is the direction that they'll be moving in. We're not going to have any difficulties with Queensland or New South Wales or Victoria or Western Australia in that. Labor states that are run by essentially socialists in South Australia and probably to a lesser extent Tasmania, I'm not as familiar with it, but certainly the education system in South Australia is run by socialists. If the Labor governments in South Australia or Tasmania or elsewhere try and stand in the way of that, we will need the political will to say, well, we're not going to fund those discretionary programs through your state governments. And we've done it before. Our literacy and numeracy program was a voucher program under the Howard government. It had a 98% success rate in improving outcomes. It was one of the very first things the government abolished because it was a voucher system, and the education unions regarded it as the Trojan horse for vouchers. Of course, it wasn't, but it indicates how ideology has been driving education policy in this country for far too long.
Do you want a drink of water?
Yes, thanks, Jared.
Dorothy. We've got time, folks.
Chris, granting or not, I'm the principal of Holroyd High School, which is a disadvantaged school in Sydney. A question about pre-service training, the quality of new prospective teachers. We're talking about drawing from the 30% top of the ATAR list and so on. How do you propose to achieve that, given the current structure of the teacher training programs, which allow only for a very limited practicum, for example, and little experience at school, and for the limited career pathways for teachers in schools, coupled with the plateauing of salary that happens after, say, 8 years in teaching? There's a 40% approximately attrition rate of young teachers within the first 5 years of teaching from the system. And that's partly because they can't get permanency and so on, and partly because of these barriers. How do you think the government might move to address those issues?
Well, that wasn't a Dorothy Dixer question, but it could easily have been one. obviously you've hit the nail on the head. I mean, you can't attract good young people or older people to teaching at university to become teachers if at the end of that they are going to be in an antiquated, very tightly controlled career environment. Generation Y are not interested in that kind of environment. Young people want to go into an environment where the harder they work, the better they will be remunerated, or that their emoluments will improve as a consequence. And one of the ways we are going to have to entirely turn the teaching, the way we view teachers on its head in Australia, is to end this ludicrously tightly controlled industrial system in the teaching market. Now, that is very much a role for the states to do, but nobody believes that shouldn't be attempted. I won't speak for Adrian, of course, he's got enough troubles with the Teachers Federation, but it's certainly true that it's not good enough for a young person to start a teaching job and then doesn't matter whether they take the rugby team or whether they train the debating team or whether they stay at school late or whether they get to school early, they'll only improve their financial support based on their tenure at a particular government school. And it's soul-destroying, I'm sure, for those young men and women who see teachers who are much, much older, who've essentially are in pre-retirement phase and not doing any of those things and simply getting paid a great deal more because they've been there longer. Nothing could sap the confidence more. And if you are a young person, looking at that and thinking, I could do that career or I could do another career, you're not going to choose the teaching profession. So both of these things go hand in hand. The teaching at universities has to be a lot more interesting and practically based. The federal government can affect that because we have university compacts with all the universities and their funding is based on these university compacts. In terms of the way teachers are paid, the Commonwealth will need to work with the states on that matter. That is really something we need to encourage the states to do. Again, we don't want to run schools. Schools and school systems should be run by the Catholic system, the independent schools, and by state governments. But you are absolutely right. You cannot have real reform without reforming the way teachers are remunerated, as well as the training of teachers. I can help with the training of teachers. The remuneration of teachers is something the states need to do. But if you go into any staff room amongst schools in Australia, they will tell you there are 10 to 15% of teachers in that staff room are basically underperforming. And I don't think we need more teachers. I think we need less teachers who are better remunerated and have less time filling out red tape and bureaucracy. The federal government collects a great deal of information that has no bearing at all on our policy responsibilities. We are responsible for the school funding model of non-government schools, and yet we collect a tremendous amount of data, which costs a lot of money every year to analyse and deal with, and employs a great number of public servants in Canberra, none of which we have any requirement to collect. And just by not collecting that data, we would save teachers and principals a lot of time to do the job they want to do, which is to educate our young minds.
David? Noel?
Chris, firstly, I commend your courage. You gave a wonderful example of a public school principal sitting in a room against principals from independent schools. And she must have been thinking, geez, I wish I could pay the teachers that left my school and went to the neighbouring independent school enough money to come back. If we're going to maintain funding for independent schools, something which I would anticipate most people will support, and we're going to do maybe some what Gonski recommends, how will we make it possible, because ultimately states depend on Canberra for money, to allow those public school principals to pay good teachers and attract them back from the private system?
Well, again, that is a matter for each state government to address. And one of the reasons why I think education and these decisions should stay in the hands of the states, and why I don't support the Gonski recommendations about a national school funding authority, is because the states are responsible to the electors in their states. Western Australia is currently investing heavily in school education. I hope the voters of Western Australia will give Colin Barnett a tick for that at the appropriate time next March. states that don't invest or disinvest in their school education systems, I hope voters in those states will punish them accordingly. And that is one of the dangers of nationalising school education in Canberra, is that the responsibility for the schools sits with the state governments, and yet the voters will have lost their capacity to punish the government closest to them for making bad decisions in education. But as part of the reform of education and teachers, state governments might well want to address the issue of freeing up the remuneration of teachers, making it easier for underperforming teachers to be moved on, paying teachers who perform better more, and I know that's what Victoria has announced in recent times, much to the chagrin of some of the teacher unions, but they are ploughing on with it because they see it as an important reform to encourage teachers not to go to the non-government school system. But I think it's also tremendous that government principals are so determined to stay in the public school system and support students who need proper education, good education. One of the things that's been remarkable in Western Australia in the independent public schools model is that it was expected that middle class or affluent suburb government schools would take up the opportunity to be independent public schools. What was actually found was that schools in affluent or middle class suburbs of Perth thought, well, actually it's all going pretty well here. We don't want to do that. It was the schools in the harder luck areas of Perth, the tougher suburbs of Perth, where young principals or not so young principals with passion for the public education system said, hallelujah, this is what I've been wanting to do. And being given the opportunity to be independent and run like a non-government school, have grasped the nettle and run with it, and are having tremendous outcomes, not just for their school but for the communities that they're in, because the school is so important to the community, to its health. I was at a school in Western Australia where they had a program for, this was a junior, a primary school, they had a program for parenting, a program, an employment program for parents, a program for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders, and even a program for the children recently out of prison or for juvenile detention in a junior school. So this was a tough area. And the principal was a 30-something young woman, very passionate about public education, and the effect of her in being able to make decisions in her school was penetrating throughout the community. So that's the kind of passion we want to bring to the government system that currently non-government school principals already have. They make a decision, they can implement it. But in the government system, like the fellow in Brisbane who asked for an English teacher and got a fine arts teacher, they were probably a marvellous fine arts teacher, but they weren't necessarily what the person wanted.
Kevin.
Christopher, thank you for your address.
Kevin.
Issues that I'd like to explore with you, if I could. The first is Teach for Australia. It's something I am familiar with because the Origin Engine Foundation has provided funding to that program. What's, I suppose, interested me is the fact that some academics in the education sphere have been critical of the program on two grounds. One is that the young graduates going out to teach are seen as not appropriately trained. And even more shocking is that apparently it is not seen as a vocation for life. It's a bit like Peace Corps, you, sort of thing you might do for your country, and then after 3 or 4 years you might move on. So I'd just be interested to get your comments on that. The second is that in tertiary education we're beginning to explore different modes of instruction. Your address said you were going to focus on teacher excellence. But I just wondered if the Coalition had or you as the Shadow Minister, had given attention to a policy in relation to e-learning, because in many ways the way we teach in classrooms might be rather old-fashioned. Certainly in the United States, in the tertiary field, there's some very interesting developments in terms of e-learning, which are going to have major implications for Australian universities. So I just wondered if I'm not familiar with what might be happening in that area in the secondary schools.
Well, thank you, Kevin. In terms of the first, the other aspect to Teach Next or Teach First or Teach for Australia that has been discovered is that many more undergraduates who take up the opportunity to do these programs stay teaching for much longer than they'd ever anticipated because of the enjoyment or the thrill they get from educating young Americans or British students or Australians. So quite the opposite actually happens. And then, of course, other teachers see the calibre of people teaching in their school and think teaching is not such a bad profession after all. Now, a lot of academics in education have a lot of opinions about many things, and you'll always be able to find an academic in education who has a different view. They're like lawyers, Kevin. I mean, I'm a lawyer, of course, and you're a lawyer, so we can say that, but you can always find an academic to give you a different opinion. The truth is, a lot of people in education feel very threatened by programs like Teach for Australia, and for that reason, often central bureaucracies try and smother programs like Teach for Australia, because things like Teach for Australia or Teach Next or Teach First, or they actually sometimes show up, amazingly, show up the current crop of academics or teachers or education bureaucrats who've been saying we have to do something in a certain way for 20 years, and it's very hard for them to say that was the wrong way to do it. Now, I think we are heading in the wrong direction in terms of our education in Australia, and I think returning to old-fashioned teaching methods is not such a bad idea. In the Cape York, for example, and the Exodus Foundation in Western Sydney with Reverend Bill Cruz, and the Jesuit education system from which I come, whole language learning was never took off. Things like multi-lit and phonics has been the way that children have always been taught. And in Cape York, the bureaucracy insisted that whole language learning and direct literacy and so on was the way to teach young Indigenous children in the Cape York. It was manifestly unsuccessful, and when Noel Pearson shifted to multi-lit, which is basically phonics, the result has been transforming for the Cape York Peninsula. That hasn't stopped the Queensland Department of Education trying to shut it down and insisting that, in fact, they have a better way. Well, they've had their chance. It didn't work. And governments have to be prepared to say, we're going to go with what works. And if the private sector has a better model, there's no reason why the government should choose to replicate it. We should simply accept what's been done successfully and use it. In terms of e-learning, well, different schools have different approaches. Some schools... Are you talking about universities or schools? Yeah.
Schools.
Some schools embrace e-learning and every child with an iPad from the very earliest stages, and some bring them in later on, in year 7 or year 8 or year 9. I'm a thousand flowers bloom kind of person, and I think what works should be done. And that's one of the reasons I have some doubts about the national curriculum, because I think it is very prescriptive, and I don't want to see the national curriculum doing things like discouraging Emilia Reggio teaching or Jewish forms of teaching or small Waldorf Astoria school. Not Waldorf Astoria, that's the hotel. I've forgotten the word. Waldorf. Steiner education. It's called the Waldorf school in Jamie Briggs' lecture in Mayo, which is why it's confused with. Oh, the Waldorf Astoria is an excellent hotel, on the other hand. Yes, hopefully they can sponsor the next Waldorf school in the hills. But I don't want to see the national curriculum crowd out that kind of inventive thinking or innovation. Now, if a school wants to grasp the opportunity to use e-learning early, they should be encouraged to do so. Equally, if they don't want to, they shouldn't have to. So in my state, the school that had the highest result in the NatPlan, whose name escapes me momentarily, which is in Unley. It starts with a W. Anyway, they embrace e-learning.
Waldorf.
No, it's not Waldorf. Could be, though. They embrace e-learning very early. And the other school that came second, which was St. Ignatius, which is the Jesuit school, they don't embrace e-learning until much later. And they work on the basics, and they believe their students should know the basics before they jump to computers making a lot of decisions for them. Well, one of them came first and one of them came second in the NatPlan. So, you know, it's horses for courses. I think each school should be able to make its own decisions about that.
Now, we're getting right to the end. We're going to have to finish by 7. So we've got
Walford is the school that came top in the NatPlan in South Australia.
Okay, so we've got one question here and one question behind. Yeah, that'll be quick.
don't see a lot of surgeons out on strike very often, so I'm wondering about upping the entry, the aggregates for getting into uni, making teaching a much harder thing to get into at university, you know. Doesn't that promote a better teacher?
Sort of? Well, it also might have the impact, of course, of nobody taking up teaching. So it's really a bit of a chicken and the egg. Our interlocutor over here talked about the need to make teaching attractive through remuneration and so on, and career advancement. But simply raising the ATAR score to go into university would probably simply mean a great deal less applicants for teaching. Yes, we have to get the score increasing, and there are methods to do that, but simply unilaterally deciding the score to get into teaching is, say, 80, would simply mean you'd have much smaller class sizes for teaching. So, yes, the fact the ATAR score is so low is an indicator that there's a problem in teaching, but it really indicates that less and less people are wanting to do teaching for a whole host of reasons. Now, for example, you don't need to have 99 to be an orthopaedic surgeon. Most people could study medicine. Most people could study law. Obviously, you can't be completely stupid. But the reason the score is 99 is because of the competition to get into it, as you point out. Being an orthopaedic surgeon is a great profession in terms of the emoluments. But the reason the score for teaching is so low is because so few people want to do it. And that's the reason, that's where we have to change it. The more attractive you make teaching, the score will inevitably rise as a consequence as more and more people choose to do it. When I was in year 12, the score to get into physiotherapy was about 360. It was out of 500 in those days. But as physiotherapy became a very attractive profession and a very lucrative one, it rose to well over 400. So the score reflects the number of people who want to do it rather than the ability that you need to be able to do it.
Got a final question here. Yeah.
In May, the Australian Chief Scientist published a report which highlighted the serious and continuing decline in the so-called STEM subjects, science, technology, engineering and maths. And took all sorts of quantified consequences in terms of infrastructure development in Australia, wealth creation. I think most people agree the solution to that lies in the teachers. I guess my question for you is, has the coalition recognised that? And would you consider putting together a specific STEM-related policy, as the UK has done, with industry support, and the US is also doing?
Well, it's a very good question. And one of the things that my office and I have been working on in the last 6 to 12 months is to get the government to continue to support the Maths and Science Olympiads, for example. Remarkably, the government had not committed to continuing to support the Maths and Science Olympiads. Again, they said, oh no, we have a better program that will run out of the bureaucracy. Our argument was that this is really a non-partisan issue. Why would you replicate what thousands of volunteers are doing around Australia, which has a history of producing great maths and scientists? The more serious problem that you've raised, though, is that it's very hard to get young people to become science and maths teachers when they weren't studying maths and science themselves at school. You can't suddenly take someone who stopped maths in year 10 and say, at university we're going to teach you to be a maths and science teacher. So one of the challenges for in education is to make maths and science attractive enough for students to stay doing it right through to the end of year 12. Then you'll find teachers who prepare to be maths and science teachers. And this is a serious national issue, though. Because obviously an economy that relies on innovation, that relies on not having low labour market costs, but in fact high labour market costs, and therefore needs to stay in front of its competitors through innovation, needs good engineers and scientists and geologists and mathematicians and physicists and others. So this is a national priority for Australia. And it's not getting any better. So we do need strategies for attracting students to maths and science at school so that they'll then become maths and science teachers themselves. And I don't think, again, the teaching at universities is reflecting what needs to be done to produce that as actual teachers in the classroom, because if the teaching course has got to focus on philosophy and history of education rather than maths and science or practicum, placements that give people a love of maths or science or geology or engineering or other things, then it's not going to make any difference how many government programs there are. These things have to start at the earliest stage.
many things. Just step aside for a second.
Sorry, Jared. No, you're right on time. We're all right. There are more questions, but it's 1:01 and we're going to stop where we always stop. You stay there. I'll be very brief. Thanks for coming along tonight. Christopher Pyne, I guess, is one of the best known politicians in Australia. We know he's a fine performer. We know he's a great communicator. But what tonight we've seen is the Shadow Minister for Education speaking with a great deal of passion about a topic he knows well and obviously very much believes in. And when people say that there are people in politics who don't believe in things these days, well, I don't accept that, and obviously Christopher Pyne doesn't, because you've shown tonight that you do believe in things. So we're very grateful you came along. It's an important talk. No doubt you'll be back in the future, but for tonight, thank you and well done.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.